new residents in Jammu and Kashmir region. Local authorities said the measure introduced just 2 days before had been withdrawn and was to be treated as void without providing further details. It came 2 months after the Narendra Modi-led BJP government in New Delhi announced that around 2.5 million voters are expected to be added to the voter list in the region, which would increase the electorate by more than a third from 7.6 million presently. The announcement sparked angry and spontaneous protests in the Muslim-majority Himalayan region, with political parties unanimously denouncing the move, fearing demographic changes. In a tweet last week, the region's former chief minister, Mehbooba Mufti, accused New Delhi of creating religious and regional divisions in Kashmir, saying the attempts must be thwarted. She had previously described the move to allow non-locals to vote as the last nail in the coffin of electoral democracy in the region, equating the BJP government with Nazi Germany and Israel. Mufti's political rival and former chief minister, Omar Abdullah, also decried the move, accusing the BJP of importing voters to win power in Kashmir.
India stripped the disputed Himalayan region of its semi-autonomy in August 2019, reorganizing the erstwhile Jammu and Kashmir state into two federally administered territories. It also introduced changes in the constitution to allow non-locals to vote in the elections and buy properties in Kashmir. Before 2019, voting rights were limited to permanent residents only, guaranteed under Article 370 of the Indian Constitution. The law also barred Indians from outside Kashmir from permanently settling, buying land, and holding local government jobs in the region.
The decision to allow voting rights to non-local Kashmiris living temporarily in the region has ignited anger and fury in recent months, stoking fears of yet another attempt by the Hindu nationalist government in New Delhi to dilute the Muslim-majority region's demography. Among the new voters included Indian Army personnel, government and private sector employees, and migrant workers, as authorities had declared there was no need for an Indian citizen to have a domicile certificate or to be a permanent resident to get enlisted as a voter in the region. It was seen by local political parties and civil society groups as a cunning ploy to redraw the electoral map and change the region's demography. Since August 2019, when Kashmir's semi-autonomous status was abrogated, a series of laws have been introduced to allow the Hindu nationalist BJP to gain a foothold in the Muslim-majority region. As per the Indian government's last census in 2011, Kashmir had a total population of about 12.5 million, of which Muslims comprised 68.31% and Hindus 28.43%. Some pundits see the BJP government's decision to add non-locals to the voting list in the region as the final solution to the long-standing dispute, which has seen India and Pakistan go to war at least three times.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Zia Ahmed, the editor-in-chief of the Srilesian Muslim Times. Welcome to the program, Mr. Ahmed. Now, the Indian government has for now scrapped the rule that granted voting rights to non-local Kashmiris in Kashmir. Is this U-turn the result of growing anger and outrage in the region?
There is widespread anger amongst Kashmiris within the region as well as in the Kashmiri diaspora spread all over the world over Indian government's oppression of Kashmiris and violation of their human rights. Yes, this U-turn may be, due to the fact that the Hindu nationalist government has realized that they have crossed the red line by granting voting rights to the non-Kashmiris in Kashmir. And this blatant move may inflame the situation further in the region. Moreover, the BJP government is also preparing for a number of state elections as well as the national election in 2024. And strategically, they may have thought to calm the situation down in Kashmir and elsewhere in the rest of India and against the criticism of minorities within India itself.
Mr. Ahmed, the popular opinion in the Himalayan region points to apprehensions amongst people that the Hindu nationalist government in India wants to change the region's demography. I want to see your assessment on this.
Moreover, the BJP government is also preparing for a number of state elections, as well as the national election in 2024. And strategically, they may have thought to calm the situation down in Kashmir and elsewhere in the rest of India, and against their criticism of minorities within India itself. Kashmir is a disputed region between India and Pakistan, and it was for the indigenous people of Kashmir to decide whether they wanted to stay within the Union of India or opt to merge with Pakistan in accordance with the United Nations Resolution in 1947. But unfortunately, on 27th of October, which is observed as a black day by the Kashmiris, since on this day, 75 years ago, India took control of state of Jammu and Kashmir militarily, with the promise of self-determination of Kashmir through a plebiscite of referendum. Now, it has been almost three quarters of a century that India has reneged on its promise for the legitimate rights of Kashmiris to hold a plebiscite and have their self-determination, whether they want to stay with India or to merge with Pakistan or even to stay independent. Now, India has been over all these 75 years did not hold this plebiscite or referendum, and now they have blatantly annexed Kashmir without any consultation. Now, India has occupied Kashmir with its iron fist of its military, and gradually making moves to change the demography of this only Muslim majority state in the country by settling non-Kashmiris in Kashmir, and eventually to dilute the indigenous religious, cultural, and linguistic nature of the Kashmiris' ethnic majority.
Last but not least, since August 2019, a series of measures have been taken by the BJP government in New Delhi to integrate Kashmir with the Indian Union. And now, how do you sense the mood in the region today?
So the Kashmiris have been seeking self-determination since 1947, which Indian government has not allowed in spite of the promises made through the United Nations. And now, blatantly in August 2019, the BJP government virtually annexed Kashmir, with a large influx of military in the region, which was already the largest militarized region in the whole world. They put more military there, and they knew that they were going to be opposition by the Kashmiri people, but they basically shut everybody within their houses. And then, especially with the pandemic, COVID-19 coming in as well, they really oppressed the Kashmiris, that they could not hold any rallies or show any opposition to the government's move. The mosques were closed, and they're closed now and then again. The freedom of movement, the freedom of expression, even educational institutions get closed now and then. So they are really completely shutting the say and the wishes of the Kashmiri people and oppressing them. It is very similar to just like an occupying power, what the Israelis have done in Palestine, where they have completely took control of the indigenous people and violated their human rights and completely disregarded their rights of self-determination, just like Israelis have done to Palestinians. The same textbook copy is being perpetrated in the region of Kashmir as well. And of course, India and Israel collaborate with each other on these issues gradually and globally. If people want to understand, it's a very similar situation what is in Palestine with oppression by the Israelis. The Indian government is enacting the same kind of oppression in Kashmir as well. In addition to that, the BJP government is a Hindu nationalist government, and it wants to create a Hindu nation in India and eventually oppressing its minorities into submission. And even there is a danger that if these moves are not stopped, there might be a genocide of minorities, especially Muslims, in India. And India Muslim population is very big. There are about 200 million Muslims out of say a billion Indians. It's not that easy to submit or wipe them out through genocide. What they will do is they will make the position of Muslims in India and especially in Kashmir unbearable, miserable, and very hard to live in India. And that is going to be a problem not only for India, but it's going to be a problem for the whole world if this kind of oppression is allowed to take place in India and especially in Kashmir.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Zia Ahmed, the editor-in-chief of the Sri Lankan Muslim Times. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Sayed Samer Abbas, a Pakistani journalist, says India was forced to withdraw the controversial law designed to change the demography of Kashmir, commending the efforts of the region's political leadership. Journalist Raisa Wickramatung quotes from an article by Makhnoon Wani that the long-standing conflict in Kashmir cannot be brushed aside while making critical decisions about the territory. Arif Ayyub, a Mumbai-based activist, asserts that India has not helped its cause by scrapping Article 370, adding that Kashmir's demography is being mutilated to eradicate its Muslim majority status.
And that was our episode about the hijab ban in India and the hypocritical stance of Indian celebrities on the issue. And also, the Indian government's decision to scrap the rule allowing non-resident Kashmiris to vote in the region. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care. علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة. The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of prophethood and messengerhood. We are currently focusing on the understanding of the reasons and the circumstances of the society which led to the coming of the prophets. And we say that one of the reasons that Imam Ali alayhi salam mentions is that people had different paths in terms of understanding God. So he says, for example, here, وَطَرَائِقُ مُتَشَتِّتَةٌ بَيْنَ مُشَبِّهٍ لِلَّهِ. There was one group of people, their path, their style of understanding God was that they would compare God to the creation. And, you know, sometimes even say that God is one of the created entities, like a mountain or a cow or even a human being with cow-like attributes of just eating and drinking and just enjoying life, and who didn't have any purpose. Unfortunately, some people just worship such an entity like the Pharaoh and, you know, other entities. And another group of people that Imam Ali alayhi salam says, أو مُلْحِدٍ فِي إِسْمِهِ. That means a person who is a disbeliever because of him focusing, or rather drowning in trying to understand the name of God. Now, what does that mean? Inshallah, we will discuss about that in the coming segment.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. Imam Ali alayhi salam talks about another group of people in their understanding of God, and that is that they are mulhidin fi ismihi. They are people who have disbelieved fi ismihi, but because of them being so much engrossed in the name of God. That means they did not go further than the name of God. They remained, under the barrier of ignorance and could not go further than the name of God. Now, what does that mean? See, there were certain, in the past, people, they, for example, gave some names to God. They knew they had this primitive concept or understanding of the fact that there is a God. And then they would give this name to God. They would say, for example, Allah. Or they would say, for example, in another language, they would say Yahweh. Or, in, for example, in Swahili, they would say Mungu, let's say. In another language, they would say, for example, Mosi, whatever. They give different names to God. And these names, when you ask these people, then, okay, now you've understood this is a name for God, but then who is that God? They would not be able to answer you properly. And therefore, they would, for example, sometimes, apply this name on entities, or they would apply this name on, for example, let's say on a thing or an object. And this was a problem. You see, here the problem was that these people, they were not able to go further in their understanding of God. The problem with this group of people was not like the first one. The first one, they had an understanding of God, but they compared God to another entity in this world. These people, they had a weakness, a deficiency in their understanding of God. So they just reached the level where they would give a name to that God. But then when it went further to define the essence, rather to kind of have a concept about what would be the example or the instance of who a God is, they would not be able to go further. And therefore this would be just an empty name that would be applicable to different entities. like an empty shell that could be filled with anything inside. And an empty, you can say, concept that could be stolen by anyone and that the devil could use to wear, to make it wear on anyone. So that's the problem that these people faced in the past. But in the later generations, it manifested in another way, inshallah, that we shall discuss today.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, when it comes to this idea that people were so engrossed in the name of God that they became disbelievers, in this day and age we have the same problem. That people, they kind of get, you can say, a certain form of deviation in terms of understanding God, and they give him a name, and then that name doesn't take them further to have a connection with the essence of God. So let me give you an example. They, for example, say that God is nature. Nature is God, God is nature, right? It sounds like a very good thing maybe for some people, but that means that the way you relate to this God is not different from the way you would use nature. I mean, you interact with nature, you eat food, you enjoy nature. But then more than that, there is nothing else because that is God for you. So there is nothing further beyond that which you can connect with, which is actually what God is. God is not this nature. But because they've given such a name to God, you see that people then just become materialistic and they don't go further. They don't have that spiritual closeness and perfection. Or for example, they say God is the laws of cause and effect that exist in the universe. Like if God is the laws of cause and effect, that means these are so intangible, so black and white and unfeeling concepts that you cannot relate to. Rather, you cannot relate to this God in that way because God is just a bunch of laws and rules and regulations that govern this universe. But what we say is that God is the maker of these laws. God is the creator of nature. Not that God is these things. For example, some say God is energy. And then they get confused and they don't know how to take it further. So these, the people who name God in such a manner that they become, unfortunately, disbelievers in the actual God. This is another form of deviation, inshallah. We pray to Allah that He stops us from entering into such forms of deviation. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss your problems, questions you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. A child is like a white paper on which you can write good things or bad things. Entire personality of a child is developed by the parents, by the upbringing they do. And in this program, we try to provide all the necessary information that is required to bring up your child in the best possible way. The answers of your questions are based upon Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member of Al Mustafa University and researcher in the Hausa Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, Professor Nakavi, in our previous episodes, we have been talking about the developments of a child, and we said in a physical development, in a cognitive development, and in emotional development, these developments should not become barriers for other developments, especially emotional aspect of parents or trainers should not become a barrier for the cognitive development of a child. Would you like to add more to the topic?
As far as this development goes, it's all intertwined. You can't separate it, of course, but you can focus on certain areas. As we talk about cognitive development, a child, for example, starts off with numbers and shapes and colors, and there should be an environment where he or she is able to understand these things,
yeah,
in an informal way while playing. When we talk about the kindergarten, Montessori form of education, it says that we're talking about learning while playing. Whether we agree with the concept or not, that's different. But when we're at home and we want to teach our children, educate them and groom them, of course, cognitive development, as is physical development or even emotional development, it starts from the womb of the mother.
Yeah.
So certain things have to be taken care of, as I mentioned before, what the mother is thinking about, how she's feeling, what she's eating. Everything has an effect on the child in the womb. So that is one very important thing that we have to take care of. And what we should be doing, we should learn how to do that proper things to be eaten.
So even in cognitive development, you're saying it does not start where a child starts understanding things.
It actually starts before that. Cognition, understanding. Certainly, there's a certain level of cognition in that realm. We cannot say that's completely not there. But when a child is born and the conditions are much more in your control, you need to develop an environment where it becomes conducive for his learning and cognitive development.
True.
And for every specific age, for every level, there are certain things which have to be taught, whether it's numbers or shapes or colors or even gradually mathematical issues, arithmetic, and they can be done in a playful way.
Okay.
Reading book, then starts reading and listening. Everything has a role to play in the cognitive development of the human being. There are certain children who are better than others in mathematics.
Yeah.
Or in other, some are good in arts and the fine arts. Because their cognitive development has taken a different route at that beginning, the beginning of their lives. But we need to develop a general level of cognition. And then, of course, we certainly believe that cognition, development of cognition and skills, cognitive skills, goes hand in hand with emotions and physical development. But the emotions should not become a barrier and impede that growth. The emotions should be developed based on cognition.
All right.
Understanding. A child should be made to learn that, yes, one should be showing his feelings or her feelings, but there's a cognition behind that. There's something to be known beyond that.
All right.
Of course,
it should be within.
You can't philosophize with a child, but yeah, you have to make him understand and realize.
All right. Well, we'll talk more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Professor Nakavi, and we are discussing what should be in the minds of parents and trainers while they are doing development. Emotions should not become barriers, especially in cognitive development. Well, Professor Nakavi, before going to the break, you said a very important point that a child, when he grows up tomorrow and he takes a certain field, some go for fine arts, some go for science, some go for mathematics, and this is what somewhere their cognitive skills have rooted from in the very early age of their life. But we have parents who often force their children in a very, for example, after passing their 10th class exams, parents often come and they force their children, you have to go to a particular field because I want you to become a doctor or I want you to become an engineer. So you're suggesting for such parents that why not work from very beginning, develop his cognitive skills in a way that he himself chooses that field rather than you forcing him tomorrow.
Exactly. It should be a choice of his own. Of course, if you want him to become take up a certain profession in his future life, then the parents should take care that they're upbringing in such a way. Provide that environment. I remember a person, was talking about a personality who, while he was sitting in his home country in the subcontinent somewhere, he was saying, look, I have so many children. And he had 10, 12 children. He said, I will train two of my children to become people who are motivational speakers, who can educate people and go to the West to do that.
Okay.
And migrate to the West. So he, in his hometown, he provided them an environment where they were learning about the West and go for example, tabligh in the West. So all their upbringing was in such a way, such a fashion, that way they were becoming prepared for that.
Becoming a motivational speaker.
Speaker, for example, for the West. So they have to develop their language, they have to develop the understanding of that part of the world, the geography of that part of the world, the history of that part of the world. So many things have to be taken care of. So if you want your child to become an alim, for example, then you have to provide him such an environment.
Yeah.
If you want him to be a good, competent student, even you need to provide him that initial. I mean, you can't just allow him to be to grow up on his own without any grooming, and allow him to go into the streets and just learn things without any control, without any guidance. That's not the proper way.
All right.
You can't if you can't expect a child to become what you want without putting in that effort. So you need to develop that cognition, you need to develop that emotions. The emotions should be channelized towards the truth.
All right.
I mean, when we talk about faithful believers, believers who have faith and the love of God in their hearts, so that should come with that cognitive understanding that Allah is our Lord, is our Master, is our Creator. So gradually that understanding, cognitive understanding, has to be developed, and which should lead to that emotional attachment to God.
Okay.
So we need to develop the emotions based on that cognitive learning.
All right. We'll talk more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Professor Naqvi, and we are saying, when folding, what things you have to take care of while you're providing cognitive development to your child? Yes, Professor.
I mean, one of the most important things for a person to become a good, successful human being in future life is being a creative person.
Yeah.
A person who can carry out critical analysis of things, evaluate things, make good judgments. So you need to develop that. Mostly when we are faced with questions from our children, we snub them because most of the times we don't know the answers.
Yeah.
Or when a child is, for example, is curious, he wants to break up something and open it up, we stop him from doing so. So that creativity is not developed. That critical analysis of things and evaluation of things is not developing.
All right.
So we need to provide that environment where this creativity is developed, along with the emotions, proper emotions, the attitude that what he wants to achieve, he should strive for it. He should work for it. He should take the pressure. He should take the trouble to do things. We shouldn't pamper children and we provide them everything that they need without them making the effort.
Yeah.
So we need to provide them the proper cognitive development, emotional development. Their love and hate should be focused and channelized towards the truth.
Okay.
We should make them love others, not just because they are your beloved ones, your siblings, or your no, because they are human beings, and God Almighty has commanded us to respect all human beings, especially our parents. It's not because of that personal greed that I should be respected as a child, as a parent, or a child shouldn't feel that he has to be taken care of in any way possible and at any cost. No, he should feel that, yes, my parents love me. They are providing me with the things I need. I need to make an effort myself. So that attitude,
it's really hard to develop that attitude.
That is very important. That attitude important. To be able to face problems and troubles.
And even solve them. If the problems are there, a child should have the ability to solve them.
So he has the attitude first to be able to face issues in life, face problems in life, The child should not be, as I said, basic requirements are to be provided for, but many things have to be developed that the child goes out to do them himself or herself. He shouldn't all the time be looking upon his parents or elder siblings to do those things.
Yeah.
So the physical development comes in here, the nutrition comes here, the proper physical skills come in. Starting from small chores, small household thing, work that has to be done.
Mm-hmm.
So starting from that and then going on to, for example, taking care of oneself.
All right. Thank you so much, Professor Nakavi. We have had a very good conversation. You made clear for us a lot of things that could unconsciously become barriers in our development. And listening to that was really helpful for me as a parent and definitely for other parents as well. Thank you so much to our listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you want to listen to our programs again, please go back to our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. If you have any questions, any suggestions, any comments for our program, please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also search us on our social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. And when you go to our official website, parstoday.com, you'll find a tab, Call of Islam. Over there, you can find our programs. Until another session, fi amanullah, God bless you all.
Do you know Islam says, it says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Economic divide.
Here's a UK mini budget, but the projections are wrong. I'll stick with it anyways. No, wait, I may have it wrong. Let's make amendments. That's right. That's the way and the state of the economy played out in front of the world by the UK and Prime Minister Liz Truss, who stands on extremely shaky grounds. And just as we were recording this program, we got news that Jeremy Hunt reversed almost the entire income tax break for millions. Hi, I'm Kavit Ahwe. This is Economic Divide. Coming up, UK economy, strikes, possible blackouts, plunging currency. How much more can it go wrong for the UK? Then, taking a look at what has been called a mini-budget disaster. That's what she presented, and that's what happened. Then U-turns after U-turn to slash bills with windfall tax, and then resignations for Prime Minister Liz Truss. And then we take a look at Europe's economy. How's Europe doing? Well, recession in Europe, energy rationing is occurring. There's suggestions of blackouts, suggestions of gas to be rationed. And of course, we're taking a look at a global economic recession that's looming in the horizon.
UK's economy is facing a gloomy outlook. Britain's economy looks set to go into a recession, as data shows it unexpectedly shrank in August. A government report shows the country's gross domestic product in August decreased 0.3% from July. Britain's economy is hit by the cost of living crisis and rocketing energy bills. Gloomy news comes amid market turmoil after Britain's recent debt-fueled budget. The mini-budget, as it's called, unveiled by the Chancellor, included tax cuts to boost growth in the short term, but it has faced a barrage of criticisms over its long-term effects.
There's no point trying to hide it. Everyone can see what has happened. The Tories went on a borrowing spree, sending mortgage rates through the roof. They are skyrocketing by £500 a month. And for nearly 2 million homeowners, their fixed-rate deals are coming to an end next year. They're worried sick, and everybody in this house knows it. They won't forgive. They won't forget, and nor should they. When will she stop ducking responsibility, do the right thing, and reverse her kamikaze budget, which is causing so much pain?
International Monetary Fund says it will fuel rising prices, warning the cuts would, quote, complicate the fight against soaring prices. The IMF says a high inflation is likely to be a permanent feature of the UK's economy in the coming years. Only Slovakia, out of the eurozone, is set to see a higher inflation. Inflation is expected to peak at about 11.3% before the end of the year in the UK. The IMF expects price rises will average at about 9% for the next 2 years. That is far above the target of 2% set by the Bank of England. Yet, Prime Minister Liz Truss is utterly failing to tackle the cost of living crisis overall, since the mini budget will have only one kind of growth, and that is growth in the gap between the rich and the poor. On the other hand, Truss has pledged military aid worth billions of pounds for Ukraine, as the UK is suffering from the cost of living crisis. Premiership is coming under intense scrutiny, so much so that there are talks of her being forced to resign. Let's get some analysis into our segment here. We are going to have Akib Mahmood join us for our first segment of the Q&A, a geopolitical analyst from London. Akib Mahmood, welcome. The package that UK's Prime Minister Liz Truss introduced, obviously facing a lot of criticism. She has now fired the former Exchequer Kwarteng. One of the critiques by many of the economists, that is, they said that this would lead to greater inequality. Why are there so many problems with the so-called mini-budget?
Yeah, so essentially, Liz Truss owes her premiership to groups like hedge fund managers and corporate bankers, people of that ilk, who are part of a super rich clique and form an ultra elite group that has essentially taken over the Tory party. And those are the people that she was trying to please when she introduced this mini budget and the tax cuts therein. Obviously, the markets understood that this unfunded tax cut is not going to do anything to combat rising inflation or lack of growth in the economy or income inequality. The idea that this was going to be a trickle-down economics was frankly laughable, because all of this extra wealth that would have been generated for these super rich people would just have ended up in their bank accounts, making them extra money.
Okay. Chief UK economist at Pantheon Macroeconomics, Samuel Toombs, now joins us. Samuel Toombs, welcome. The Bank of England intervening in the government bond market, buying some time, basically. Isn't this a temporary solution to UK's bigger economic problems?
We've got through a rocky couple of days for the economy. The Bank of England has now intervened in the government bond market and has bought a couple of weeks' worth of time and stability. It can't continue with its bond buying programme indefinitely. I think that ultimately that would end up being quite inflationary. But as this is a temporary targeted intervention that's set to last in the bond market for only a couple of weeks, I think that there is it's a credible action that won't boost inflation. But we do really need to see now the government grow up, look at the outlook in the financial markets and change course. It clearly has lost trust and needs to start rebuilding that quickly. And that requires it, I think, to both take greater control of government borrowing, but also set out some credible economic and fiscal forecasts to justify some of the decisions it's making. We need that independent oversight for the OBR once again. And once we get that, we will hopefully start to rebuild some credibility, and that'll ease some of the pressures in the financial and economic system.
But not pressure on the pound. What about the pound? What's going to happen to its value?
Well, I think the pound is going to have to be sacrificed in order to protect the economy. At the moment, the pound's value is based on an assumption that the Bank of England will increase interest rates all the way to 6% early next year. But I think that's simply implausible. That would entail too much pain for households and businesses, and you would see issues with financial stability because so many of those households and businesses would be struggling to make those interest repayments on their loans. And so I think it's much more likely that the Bank of England accepts that sterling weakens a bit further as a consequence of not raising interest rates too dramatically. And the consequences of that is that we see, a further wave of inflation that affects us all. That will be the price that I think the Bank of England will be willing to pay in order to prevent a financial crisis.
It's time now for our info news section of the program. This is where we take a look at other economic news from around the world. Our first item regards Iran. Iran has a new energy plan that it has introduced. It's calling for more joint projects in Eurasia, and it is urging to improve infrastructure.
It is necessary to create a joint investment fund to strengthen cooperation in the energy sector in Eurasia, is the announcement made by Iran. It also said that we can establish a joint energy consortium with the participation of both public and private companies. So Iran on the move with its business, I guess, ventures, this being in the energy field. Next up, we are going to take a look at a very important conference. This is regarding Chinese economy, of which Xi has made many statements in his Chinese Communist Party conference. He has also said that the economy sees beautiful life in Chinese nationalism and in control. Now, the Chinese President Xi Jinping has presided at this point over a new era in which it has prioritized political control over economic development. And at this point, he has delivered in his speech the rising living standards for 1.4 billion Chinese people. And he's doing that as the economy is confronting, at this point, the stiffest challenges in decades, from COVID to, of course, the world economy slowing down. Next up, a very important development regarding Lebanon and Israel, in which the gas deal was signed. It was called the historic agreement between both of these longtime foes, as some have described it. It has opened the door to offshore energy exploration, but not so fast. There are some sticking points. The deal, first of all, it has set a border between Lebanon and Israeli waters. This is the first time that that has happened. And it's largely along a demarcation line, referred to as Line 23. Now, Israel retains full rights to develop the Karish field. This is while Lebanon retains full rights in Qana, but it has a caveat there. It's rather lengthy, so we're going to leave it at that. Maybe we'll do a program on that. Who knows? Next up, take a look at Australia and the poverty in that country. One in eight people there are living in poverty, as the cost of living is pressuring people in terms of the way that they're living. Now, this is while Australia is one of the wealthiest countries in the world, yet one in eight people and one in six children live below the poverty line. Overall, 3.3 million people in Australia desperately are struggling to pay the bills and to put food on the table. There are about 761,000 children there who are denied a good start to life as a result. Those were some of the news that we picked.
Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
In order to get an idea of what happened in the UK when it comes to the so-called mini-budget, it might be a good idea to take a look at the timeline to see what actually transpired, what went down. Well, first, Truss's now former finance minister, Kwasi Kwarteng. He came in at September 23rd and announced this tax cut, which included £45 billion of unfunded tax cuts and huge increases in government borrowing. So that happened. Next up, September 26th. We're looking at how the sterling and the British government bonds went into free fall. The pound plunged to a record low against the dollar, and the British bond prices collapsed. Next, the Bank of England entered the scene. It promised to buy as much government debt in order to restore order, earmarking £65 billion for this, but it ended purchasing £17.8 billion. Well, the Prime Minister Liz Truss was being blasted for her mini plan right and left, but she had remained silent until this date, September 29th. 6 days after it was presented, sticking to her plan. Then October 3, however, a U-turn, she would reverse the plan cut to the highest rate of income tax, one of many reversals and U-turns which would dodge her in the days after the 6th of October. That brought with it action by Bank of England again, which said it would expand the program of daily bond purchases. Whether it would work or not was the question. Well, just a day later, U-turn number 2, no plans to reverse the tax cuts, in which Truss said that she would not reverse the vast tax cuts or reduce public spending. And a couple days later, boom, Truss sacks the finance or Chancellor of the Exchequer, Kwarteng, raising the corporation tax to 25%, not freeze it at 19%, with public spending to grow less rapidly. And that brings us to this question, which many Brits and analysts and officials are asking. Is Truss fit for the premiership?
No way near. They need to do a lot more, but who knows what they're going to do, to be honest, because the situation looks like it's just getting worse and worse and worse.
Awful, obviously. I mean, the people that are poor right now, that are on lower incomes, they're struggling with their heating and all their bills. Everything's gone up. Why on earth would they be cutting it for the people in a higher income bracket? It's ridiculous. London's getting worse. England's getting worse, to be honest. So, yeah, it's a stupid move, a dumb move, obviously.
Okay, hope all of that sunk in. Let's get an analysis. Akib Mahmood rejoins us. He is a geopolitical analyst who rejoins us from London. All right, Akib Mahmood, welcome back. Taking a look at what the World Economic Forum's latest chief economist's outlook has presented, they've come out with economic discontent, which is not something unusual. At this point, we're looking at that across almost all European countries. Protests are coming out. Aren't European politicians and leaders worried that their continued policies against Russia in particular and this war in Ukraine, which is led by the U.S., will lead to their economic destruction?
Well, if politicians in Europe aren't worried, then they should be worried because, as I said before, you can look at the example of Italy, where a right-wing government has come to power, where a nationalistic fervor is being whipped up. And this is what happens in these kind of situations where the economy is on a downturn and traditional politicians, liberal politicians, they don't have the answers that people are looking for. And they tend to go towards far-right or right-wing rhetoric. People tend to fall for that. As far as the politicians in the UK are concerned, they seem to be enthralled to this kind of media narrative that they cannot take a step back, and the media hype is pushing this war in Ukraine, which is almost to the point of nuclear war and nuclear destruction for both sides. And that's something that policymakers in UK and Europe will have to deal with. That's something that they're going to have to step back from very quickly, because the economic situation demands from the people are not going to be helpful in this situation. Europe is not free from the economic grip of what's going on in Ukraine, and Europe is suffering for that. And the people of Europe and UK are going to be demanding that very soon, that this war ends. However it ends, they will want to end it. So the politicians need to come up with something before things get out of hand and lead to social unrest or lead to a kind of far-right nationalistic narrative taking over of protectionism and dealing with Putin on any terms instead of equal terms or showing him lesser or in any way.
All right, let's bring back Samuel Toombs. He's the chief UK economist at Pantheon on microeconomics. Samuel Toombs, lots of pressure on Liz Truss. What do you think is going to happen to her?
There must be a lot of political pressure on the Chancellor and the Prime Minister within their own party. And indeed, in the Conservatives Party conference next week could well be a flashpoint for further protests by party members and by MPs. And of course, Liz Truss's position is somewhat vulnerable because well less than half of Conservative MPs voted for her in the final round of voting. So many did agree with Rishi Sunak, who does appear to have been somewhat vindicated by recent events and his warnings that unfunded tax cuts would be damaging for the public finances and the economy at large. And I think certainly there will be a lot of internal pressure on the leadership now within the Conservative Party to change course, given that opinion polls look pretty bleak for the Conservatives at the moment.
The UK government is now under pressure to help families suffering from high prices. Prime Minister Liz Truss has vowed to help struggling Brits, but it's widely believed that her neoliberal policies will only exacerbate the socio-economic crisis in the UK. The Bank of England has already taken an emergency action to stabilize the country's financial markets. Concerns are rising over possible social unrest in the UK and other European countries over rising energy bills and inflation rates. Analysts warn that economic discontent is now a reality across the continent. For ordinary citizens, buying bare essentials is becoming more difficult,
and there are warnings of widespread disruptions to work and industrial activities across the continent. The UK's National Grid has warned that rotating blackouts could happen this winter in the extreme case of gas shortages and reduce electricity imports from Europe. This could cause widespread disruption in UK factories and businesses. Germany, which is the Eurozone's economic powerhouse, has not ruled out that it will eventually consider gas rationing following import disruptions from Russia.
Wir werden in diesem Jahr einen Rückgang gegenüber der Projektion von April des Wirtschaftswachstums haben. Wir prognostizieren jetzt im Herbst ein Wachstum, noch ein Wachstum von 1,4%.